Hello all, and welcome into another episode of the Poach Tavern. I'm your host, as always, Charlotte, and this week we are speaking to Joel O'Connor. I'm going to just dive right into the interview. This one was a really interesting one. This is, again, one of the early ones. We're still in the early stages of interviews, so this was just intriguing. Like, you know, we're really diving in. Anyway, enjoy.
Okay, well, welcome, Joel, to the Poetry Tavern. Welcome in. How are you today? Doing good?
Yes, thank you. I'm delighted to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me on.
Yeah, no problem. So why don't we just start? You tell us a little bit about yourself. Like, what is it you do? What sort of space do you fill in poetry?
Sure. So I do a lot of sort of science-based poetry. Mm-hmm. So I'm very interested in where poetry starts, where science ends. So if I read something really interesting, like, you know, scientists have found some fossilized spider whose eyes are still glowing after like 60 million years, that gets me really interested. I'm like fascinated. So I then, you know, sort of situate an exploration on the timeline of who we are and what that is and how it kind of relates to us on a human level. And how I guess the word is de-anthropomorphize ourselves. So not see the world as in the eyes of humans, but see humans as part of the world and the wider world, and what lessons that teaches us about balance and, you know, where we are as part of all life on the planet.
Does that impact the way you like view yourself and other people, that you sort of live in this space?
Definitely. So, you know, I'm interested in sort of, as I would describe it, kind of a state of waking meditation. So very responsive to ecological things. So what gives me pleasure and reward is, you know, seeing the beauty in the world, being touched by nature, the randomness of nature, you know, and the science in nature as well, the things that we discover in terms of the way things operate. So living in that kind of ecological space, living in a meditative space as well, is kind of what shapes the way I react to the world.
Very interesting. When we were initially going back and forth on trying to set this meeting up, you mentioned a couple of times a type of poetry you invented yourself, duograms.
That's right. So as part of balance, I'm interested in, you know, internal structures of poetry as well as, you know, what the poems talk about, the balance in nature and how that affects us as humans. So many years ago, I started working on structures that were a bit like anagrams. So, you know, the letters in different orders, or a bit like palindromes as well, but not quite either. And I developed a style of poetry called a duogram, where effectively every letter in the poem has a pair. So for every A in the poem, there's another A. And if you were to cross out all the letters, you'd find that they're all even numbers of letters. So that, I hope, kind of creates a sense of balance, which the reader might feel in terms of the rhythm of the poem, even if they're not conscious of it. So I remember T.S. Eliot saying once that you should be able to understand a poem even if it's in a language that you don't understand, because you feel the rhythm, you feel the emotion, you feel what the author's saying, if they can convey it just through the structure and the way it's delivered. So with duograms, you know, I hope the same thing, that creates a neat kind of balance and rhythm in the poem. And then, you know, when you look at it, it's because on top of just writing about the poem itself, you know, there's that technical aspect of balancing the letters out as well, which is a bit of a word game and a bit of fun for me too.
Well, what is the process of writing these duograms? Is it like you write out a certain section and then you have to go back and sort of put stuff in, or do you have sort of an ideal number of letters of each, a number of like letters in mind? Like, what is the process of how do you write these kind of poems?
It's a good question. So in my mind, I'm always playing with puns or, you know, wordplay and that sort of thing. So, you know, I'll be walking around and, you know, in my mind I'll think, you know, summer murmurs, for example, and then in the back of my mind realize that they're basically the same letters in different orders. So I'll start and think, well, that's interesting to explore. How am I feeling at the moment? I'm writing a poem about my experience in summer. I've got a couple of words where the letters are, you know, more or less the same. I'll then sit down and then look at how much of a balance there is in those two words. If there's a couple of letters out, well, that'll get me started to think, well, you know, how would I write a poem that's a duogram that gives honour to the original poem, the original idea, without it being form over substance,
but
creating something and then going back and then having a challenge to make that that evenness of letters and so on afterwards. So sometimes it can be, you know, very complicated and long-winded. Sometimes it just comes together really easily. But it gives me that opportunity to, you know, do that technical aspect as well as just writing the form of the experience in the moment.
So with this form of poetry, I mean, like, in my head, this is very like a thing you write down, just because, you know, sometimes a letter can get lost in. Do you think it still lends itself to spoken word, or is this one of those ones where it's like it stays on the page because that's where it makes the most sense?
Yeah, I think, well, I think it's a form that's good for the listener. So I definitely think for the listener in spoken word, you know, my aim is to create a sense of flow, music and balance in the poems, in the same way that, you know, a haiku or something creates that rhythm in the technical structure as well. So I would hope that comes out consciously or unconsciously for the listener when they hear the poems, because of, you know, that balance.
Very cool. I was having a dig around, as I am wont to do, while I'm doing an interview, and it seems that, like, poetry isn't your only sort of creative outlet. Do you think that, like, your other outlets inspire your poetry? I mean, beyond just the scientific?
Yeah, well, I think poetry is the basis of it. So everything that I do, I think, radiates out from being a poet first. So, you know, I write plays and do different types of art, music and so on. But, you know, the text of my songs starts as poems, as many songwriters use. In my plays, you know, the monologues of the characters and so on are often, you know, have lots of puns in them and lots of wordplay and that sort of stuff. So I think it emanates from that interest of mine in playful language. Poetry is the bedrock for me. That's where it all started and what I come back to.
Lovely. Okay, I have asked you to bring two poems with you today. So let's start with one of your own.
Yep.
What have you brought with you today to talk about?
Well, I heard one of your other podcasts recently that was talking about crows, and birds fascinate me. And
me too.
I love crows and ravens. Well, corvids, because, you know, they're so incredibly intelligent, and the more we study them, the more we learn about how incredibly intelligent they are, and things that we would treat as anthropomorphic that we think might, you know, just be attributable to humans or primates, they actually possess that intelligence and that decision-making power and social structure and everything, which is sort of, you know, the foundation of my work, which is to try and create interest in the reader to go, wow, actually, this isn't just a human thing. This is something that is embedded in nature, and we're part of that, to give us a great appreciation and respect. So this poem, Crow Maths, is about research into crows that shows that they can't just count, but they actually write down quantity. So they do a thing called benchmarking, which is they'll store food in a tree and then they'll work out how much is in there and actually draw, you know, like four lines on the tree to say that there's four kind of objects in there. So
cool.
Yeah. So the question of this particular poem is, well, who did it first? The chicken and the egg thing. So they've been around longer than us. So were they doing this before we were? So this poem's called Crow Maths. Two for joy and one for sorrows. In rhyme, that's how we count the crows. By numbers, in murderous rows, we count our fates in lines of crows. But to think they're also counting us, or so say the scientists, who put them through rigorous tests and found they understand mathematics. It turns out crows knows integers, do sums in their heads and give them words. The only ones outside human arithmetic for such abstracts and mental gymnastics. They teach their young sets of sounds for place values in numerical sequence, cawing and singing of food and people with systems of corvid frequency. And while we've decried them, eyeing them with dread, thinking them omens and agents of the dead, their intense stares and tilted head glaring has just been a long study in people watching. They've been learning from us while we've called them devils, counting our hops made to ward off their evils. And now they are doing something we've learned, but late in our timeline, these remarkable birds, tally marking for inventory, using their beaks to add up their quarry, marking 2, 3, 4 in lines and objects that contain the stores of things they collect. It's a skill we know we've only possessed for 30,000 years, more or less. But if crows have been around 20 million, were they keeping score or we got scribbling? And if that's the case, then who got there first? Us as we learned to draw, or sitting above us, the laughing jackdaw?
The concept of like maybe birds did it first is really, it's really fun and interesting. I think there's always a little bit of a thing of like, is this a thing that we as clever humans worked out, or is it something that we took from nature and like watched? And what do you think makes this poem so fun? Because I think there could be a world in which a poem like this is just like an explanation of facts, but it is quite an amusing poem.
Yeah. Well, it's the playfulness, I think, that I try to put into it, which is disarming the reader, which is what my intention is to say, did you realise perhaps we're not so special and there's a wonder in the world and others who are kind of doing what we are doing, and that sort of puts us in a place in a really curious and amusing way, and then asserts the value and the respect of other life forms compared to us when maybe we're not all that.
Yeah, it sort of made me think about when the poem was talking about the birds watching us. It made me think of, I can't remember where they're from, but there's a type of fantail bird that like are considered really friendly, but actually they befriend humans just to steal their rubbish.
Right.
And people are like, oh, these birds are so friendly that they'll just come up to you, and they are literally just drawn in by the fact that humans create waste that they can steal.
Yeah.
And so they've adapted to be friendly so that humans don't shoo them away from bins, which very fun. And they're considered omens of death because they can, like, smell corpses and they will come for them. So it's really, like, fascinating. Again, I could talk about birds for eons. And the second poem I asked you to bring is one that inspires you.
So one of my own, or one that I've come across that sort of
one that you've come across that sort of like influences you, or like maybe like something that you remember when you first started poetry, anything of that kind, you know?
Yeah, I came across a book that my grandmother had given my grandfather when they got engaged in 1939, and it was an English poet called Alfred Noyes, And he'd written this sort of epic trilogy of poetry in verse all about the origins of modern science and the Renaissance and so on. And I just found that fascinating because I used to read, you know, the Guinness Book of Records and you know, the history of the world and all this kind of these books that were sort of written as if it's modern day news, but it was telling you about what was happening in, you know, 500 AD and stuff. So this book did that. It was talking about Galileo and the discovery of the telescope and sort of thing, but situating it in the drama of those people at that time as if it's now, but also kind of giving, you know, an overview of the amazing work that they were doing to create discoveries of science and astronomy and that sort of thing. So I love that because the verse structure, but also, you know, the knowledge that was in it as well. So I think that kind of work has really inspired what I do. And I wanted to read the first passage from the Torchbearers that kind of alludes to that. So this one's called Part One, Watchers of the Sky Prologue, the Observatory. At noon, upon the mountain's purple height, above the pine woods and the cloud that shone, no larger than a small white dome of shell left by the fledging wren when wings are born. By night, it joined the company of heaven, and with its constant light became a star. A needle point of light, minute, remote, it sent a subtler message through the abyss, held more significance for the seeing eye than all the darkness that would blot it out, yet could not dwarf it. High in heaven it shone, alive with all the thoughts and hopes and dreams of man's adventurous mind. Up there, I knew, the explorers of the sky, a quiet throng of pioneers, made ready to attack that darkness once again and win new worlds. Tomorrow night, they hoped to crown the toil of 20 years and turn upon the sky the noblest weapon ever made by man. War had delayed them. They had been drawn away, designing darker weapons, but no gun could outrange this. Tomorrow night, so wrote their chief, we try our great new telescope, the 100-inch. Your Milton's optic tube has grown in power since Galileo, famous, blind and old, talked with him in that darkness of the sky. We creep to power by inches. Europe trusts her giant 40 still. Even tonight, our own old 60 has its work to do. But now our 100-inch, I hardly dare to think what this new muzzle of ours may find. Come up and spend that night among the stars, here on our mountaintop. If all goes well, then at least, my friend, you'll see a moon stranger but nearer, many thousands of miles than Earth has ever seen her, even in dreams. As for the stars, if seeing them were all 3,000 million newfound points of light is our rough guess. But never speak of this. You know our press. They dismiss the one result to flash 3,000 million round the world. Tomorrow night, for more than 20 years, they have thought and planned and worked. 10 years had gone, one-fourth or more of a man's brief working life, before they made those solid tons of glass, their 100-inch reflector, the clear pool, the polished, flawless pool that it must be to hold the perfect image of a star. And even now, some secret flaw none knew until tomorrow's test might waste it all.
Yeah, that last section really, like, I think when you think of a telescope now, it's sort of like something really simple because it's been around for a while. But that last section really, like, emphasized the amount of work it would take to make the first telescope in a way that I think a lot of people don't think about now. Like, a lot of scientific equipment is just sort of there. Like, I don't know how much work it took to make the first Bunsen burner, but they're in every classroom and they're in, like, every, you know. So it's really interesting to hear someone talk about that in poetry, of, like, the work that now that we've had the developments is now sort of invisible. So it's really, that's really interesting. I appreciate you coming on today, Joel. Thank you so much. I really appreciate the poem you brought. Just before we say our goodbyes, do you have anything that you're looking to tell people about, to put out there?
Yeah, well, I've just released a book of poems called Locust, and it's all based on how grasshoppers metamorphosize into locusts in a matter of hours. They go from these benign creatures living by themselves in the desert to, you know, these armored, destructive creatures. And it draws a parallel between human politics and how we're going through another cycle around the world of political extremism, and connects the way locusts come together and have this sort of sweeping change with political influence as well, and how that can sweep through a population. I've put that book out on a website called talesfromatreehouse.com.au. So if people are interested in my poetry, they can go there. They can find me doing a reading of Locust on YouTube, also by my website, joeloconnor.net. But that's mostly what I'm sort of focused on at the moment. That's my latest book that I'm talking to people about.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming on, Joel. I hope this has been good.
Oh, it's been lovely. Thank you so much. I'm always grateful to be able to reach out to people and talk about shared interests like crows.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And that's the end of today's episode, guys. Thank you so much for coming into the tavern today. I really appreciate it. My conversation with Joel was really interesting, so I hope you guys enjoyed it as much as I did. Next week, we're talking to Dino Gel, so that'll be good too. If you want to look at Locust, all of the links will be in the show notes for this episode, so come and join us there. Bye!